Episode 6, we continue our journeys into our Hollywood destinies while Sean tries to recall all the times he's been fired. Meanwhile, Ephraim just chooses to win his way into your television.
Entrepreneurs Sean Apple, PJ Foley, and Ephraim Patel.
Welcome, and today we're going to catch up a little bit more on our breaking into Hollywood and how that felt.
Oh, are we still doing that?
Well,
some podcast listeners are like,
I finished mine, but however, we can get to the more specific nitty gritty of when you were actually touching a mouse for VFX for money for all the right reasons.
Wait. touching a mouse for VFX for money for all the right reasons.
Oh, yeah.
Getting paid.
Well, that, if you did get paid, magic. If you're one of the lucky ones who got paid.
Wait, you guys got paid? When did that happen?
I didn't get paid.
Wait a minute.
That's the way it is. Wait, in the VFX industry, no one knows what the person next to them is making.
What?
Well, that's true in a lot of industries, though. I think. Well, maybe not.
I don't know. I mean, I was about to say, this is the only industry I've ever... And then I'm like, I've never really worked in any other industry, yeah. So I don't know.
I know a lot about nothing else.
In my days of coal mining, we all knew.
I mean, that's pretty classic, though. It's classic, yo. It's pretty standard, though, for people to not know what the...
I don't know what we're doing. Continue your thought.
This guy.
No, I'm looking at the sausages and the peeking. Yeah. Sorry.
PJ, did I smoosh your head? But he's talking about the waveform.
Yeah.
It's all these visual things that you, the listener, cannot be privy to.
I think what it's about is the... Don't do it in midstream, PJ. So anyway...
What that comes about? In later.
Yeah. Don't switch horses in midstream. I just watched part of that, Wag the Dog, but that's a whole other story.
I never saw that.
It's Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro and Dennis Leary and
so they're cast members in it. Is that any good?
Wow. Yeah, not impressed. What's it about?
Yeah,
it captivated a generation.
yeah, but which one?
It's Barry Levinson, dude. All right, so there.
Oh, he's in it too.
He is. He's on the outside. He's behind the camera. You can't see him. So we're gonna wrap up our long road to success.
Yeah,
and then we'll get to
some other amazing topics.
As you notice, PJ's done.
I'm done.
Teenage is overachiever. It took us twice as long. PJ's like, hey, I got it done in 2 months.
I edited on the fly.
Right.
Yeah. It's tough to do because the fly is so small.
It wasn't that most of the last podcast was your story. Actually, that's not true. I think I ran a little long.
I wasn't going to say anything, but yeah.
No, it was seriously. Yeah, I was just like, shut up. I was listening to it, just saying, shut up, shut up. There were two roads in the woods, and I took the road less interesting.
The rambling one.
Well, yes.
All right. So
speaking of which, let's focus down.
Okay, drilling down to the next level. Sean Apple, tell us the rest of your story since you got cut short last time.
Yeah, I did.
Duh.
All right. So when we last left, I was talking about my Michigan years. I was leading up to that. By my Michigan years, and as a micro recap, PJ almost got there, but then had to go back to Michigan. But literally 12 hours later, he was back out in LA. Right?
That's what it seemed like. Yeah. Okay.
So my Michigan years and the. So Michigan years are where you thought you made it, but you didn't quite make it. So like my Michigan years out here were I did a couple of things. I worked for a small so I got fired from True Lies. Have I talked about True Lies? I don't remember.
I believe you talked about True Lies and being fired from True Lies.
Oh right, okay. So I got fired from True Lies, and then I got another job after that working for a small production company that did the Playboy News. You're welcome. You're welcome.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I got fired from that job
I'm sorry. What's the Playboy News?
Dude, I read it for the articles. I couldn't tell you what the news is.
Is it nudes? Is it nudes or news?
Sure. It was basically it was a little chat thing. And it was the comedian who I believe is not with us anymore, Richard Jenny. Do you remember Richard Jenny? comedian from the 90s. Anyway, it was him and Playboy Playmate Tina Bockrath, if I remember right.
Look it up, and I do mean look it up.
They just chatted about current events, that kind of thing. But I got fired from that job because I got the wrong bagels.
Oh, for real. That's a real thing.
I am dead serious.
Take note when working for Playboy.
Yes.
Get well, no, it wasn't the right Playboy. Bagels. No, and that is not a euphemism.
No, and it wasn't Playboy. This was a third party company that I worked for that actually, they were the vendor for this thing. So it wasn't Playboy.
Oh,
Playboy.
I see. Playboy, they're just as sweet as...
They're great.
They're so sweet.
But the we should talk about the Playboy Mansion at some point.
I've been there.
I know you have. And yeah. I've heard stories about...
Okay. Yeah,
all right. I drove through and I saw a room full of shotguns. That's all right. I saw. But
right. That's pretty much all it is. Just shotguns everywhere. The grotto's full of shotguns.
That's what... The little known thing about the Playboy Mansion is nothing but shotguns.
Yeah. That's it's really hot.
All right, so I got fired from that job, and then I think at that point I worked at Starbucks, got fired from.
I was just gonna say, how did you get fired from that?
I didn't get fired from Starbucks.
I brought bagels.
That's right, I brought, and they were like, "We have bagels." I worked there for a little bit. That was actually, believe it or not, that was a great job because it was a very social job, and visual effects is not a very social
job.
And
did you know what the people next to you were making? Or was it all secret?
I had a pretty good idea what they were making. Okay. Except for the manager,
right,
who kept calling me big guy. I was 10 years older than him, but I was big guy.
Big guy.
But, hey, big guy. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, dude. But anyway, actually, and that I actually liked that job because all the employees at that time were artists. So it was a really cool vibe, whatever. So the keys to the kingdom for me ultimately boiled down to Photoshop. I learned Photoshop really well, and then a guy that I used to work for who got out of the business and started a photo restoration company, we stayed in touch, and he was like, hey, do you want to try this thing out? And so I did, and I actually ended up getting pretty good at restoring old photographs.
Nice.
And so I had crazy Photoshop chops at some point. And
Chop Shops.
Chop Shop. That was a Chop Shop song.
Yes.
A little small one. But a mutual friend of ours who's now at ILM, who I went to college with, may I name this person's name?
That's completely up to you.
I should. She's great. Sherry Hitch.
Oh,
Sherry,
my God. I can't believe you just did that.
Oh,
Sherry. Sorry. Please, Sherry, do not sue us.
You know what? Sherry is my break into the visual effects. She is it. So she knew, I skipped a quick thing. Anyway, went from the photo restoration job to actually doing color and like color corrections and fine tuning of fine art for ANI, which is Alexander and Ishihara. It used to be a really big photo lab. It's still around. It's actually now over by you. It used to be in Hollywood.
He just pointed to PJ, by the way.
PJ, yeah. This is the visual part. So I ended up getting really good at color and that kind of thing. And Foundation Imaging was working on... Do we talk about Foundation?
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
You did. Yeah, it was a lot, oh, yeah. lot. Okay,
yeah,
that same Foundation Imaging, which all roads kind of lead to Foundation Imaging for a lot of people. But so Sherry was at Foundation, and they happened to be working on a film where they needed a color correction on film. That most of it had been TV, I think, up to this point. This was actually going to be filmed out, I think, back to film. And so she said, I know a guy who knows color really well. And so she gave me a shout. And I'd kind of been trying to, I would go and visit her and see what she was doing and stuff, see what Foundation was doing. And I always was really excited about it. And she was like, hey, I know a guy that's good with color. And they're like, all right, we'll bring him in. And same thing, you know, I met with, Sherry was really a prominent person at Foundation. So she just said, I know a guy. And that seemed to be good enough for them, you know. So I went in and really learned. I'd done a little bit of After Effects work, but I really learned After Effects on the job at that point. I knew the color and I knew color correction, so that was sort of my in. So the shortcut here, if you want to break in 1992 or whenever it is I broke in, was Photoshop, be a badass on Photoshop, get good at color correction, and then that got me in the door. Right. And then once I was in the door at Foundation, I was introduced to the world, and that pretty much has been... different connections through there have kept the roof over my head for the last, since 99 or 2000.
So young people today really should invest in a time machine, Photoshop.
I think if I could, yes, if I could recommend on how to live a life in 1993,
You would only, in 93
because this does not work for 94
right
or 95
but if you get the time 96, machine if you get the time machine you can just loop back but, so you're it's good
but the one commonality between all of us is learn a piece of software preferably something in the world you want to live in really well and that seems to be you know it's hard to have a job not knowing software and visual effects.
It's true.
Although we all know people who seem to be managing it, but so that's kind of it. And then that kind of brings me current. So, well, I mean, there's a lot of, but whatever.
Well, the other thing that I think is really important for people who are trying to break in is just developing their eye.
Right.
Really trying to, you know, when you're learning a piece of software, let's say it's Photoshop, to really try to challenge yourself to do better, always looking to get more more accurate color, more accurate. If you're doing some sort of composite or some sort of photo manipulation, to get it as close to fully believable as possible.
I have a quick story on that. When I was doing the when I was working for the company that was doing the fine art color correction stuff, I worked with a handful of artists, pretty neat, like fine artists, you know. And one guy in particular, and I really like him, and he was always super friendly with me and everything. But I stuck my foot in my mouth, but not realizing it. But I won't say his name. He's a fantastic artist. His name's Charlie White. But
Charlie, please don't sue us.
Yeah, please. But he.
Well, Charlie, you can, but nobody else.
Right. Let's limit the people are. He would come in the evenings, and we'd work on the color and all that stuff. But his thing was, he had a friend who created these monsters, you know, like maquettes, you know, like a puppet monster, super detailed and everything. And then he would go out and with a large format camera and shoot a scene of, like, I remember there was one with like kids at like a school running out of a cafeteria afraid because there's a monster coming through the door. And then the monster was then comped in Photoshop. Mm. And now keep in mind, I'd seen a lot of foundation stuff, friends with Sherry, and, you know, kind of had seen a lot of stuff come out of there. And so that's what my brain's tuned for, you know. And Charlie brought his work in, and it was fantastic. It evoked a really nice emotion. So mission accomplished, I thought, you know. It's like, and he was asking me what I think, and that's all. And I'm the hired guy here, you know, so I'm like, it looks great. I like how it's sort of campy and the kind of, and he was like, campy, and what I was like. I was like, oh, how sort of like a, it's kind of like a model inside the thing. He's like, it looks like a model to you? And I'm like,
can't be in the way. It looks totally fake.
And I was just, all I could think is, fired again. Oh. That's all I could. No, but he was actually very gracious. I think I bummed him out a little bit, but he was very gracious about it. But the point being is that you, to help develop your eye, it's an imperative to look at things that actually are. So, like, when you have a context, like when you have an actual photograph of people doing a thing, and then you're trying to superimpose another object in that, comparing what the shadows look like in the plate or in the photograph versus what your monster looks like, constantly refining that, building that in, building the color. If you look subtly, white is never white. Mm-hmm. You know, if you like, what color white is it? Warm white or is it greenish white? And that's how you start. Well, you develop your eye.
This is where those interdisciplinary skills go. Like, get any sort of film education for composition. Another thing is photography. That's kind of where I developed my eye as however it stands. But timing is also another thing. Like, you got to start getting the cinematic sense of timing.
Oh, right.
Like, why things happen in threes and fours and fives, and the rhythm. Pattern of all that.
Rhythm. Yeah, I find rhythm in editing and mm-hmm. in action to be really key.
Here's a crazy thought. Do you guys, I have this experience occasionally when I feel like a shot is working with the motion and the movement and all that, I can start to hear it. Can you hear it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It like feels snappy, you know? And like when it's not working, it feels muddy and mushy. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, that's what gets delivered.
Right.
But on the 10th, where you're like, it kills. The timing kills. I can hear it. It's snappy, you know? And then, like, you know, mission accomplished on that thing, you know?
In terms of developing an eye, one of the first tasks I gave myself when I was learning Photoshop was a Christmas present for my family. And I always work best when I'm learning with a very specific task.
I totally agree. Like, that's why tutorials are hard for me. Just random generic tutorials are hard for me.
Yeah, because you learn kind of where everything is. But if you don't, for me, if I don't use those tools with a really specific goal in mind, I can't really learn. So the task I gave myself was for Christmas, I was going to make each of my siblings, I've got four older siblings, and my parents, I was going to make each of them a photo based on old family photos. So I had this box of all the old family photos, and I scoured them looking for just the right elements. And the idea was, I'm going to make a family photo of like my brother. I'm going to take him at all these different ages and make them seem like they're all in the same room together, just hanging out.
Oh, that's cool.
So they've got their arms around each other. They're sitting on the couch together, you know, and this is all in like the old house from like the early 80s. So it's got to match the lighting, you know, the whole thing. So I had to find just the right bits, and no one else was in the photo, just that person. And so it became a real challenge to get, you know, all the little nibbly details in there.
But that's a great educational experience. That's also an experience that people won't have now, and that's matching film grain and matching, because it was all photographs at that point.
Right.
And like the dyes fade over time, the dyes fade differently, red will fade in sometimes, you know, or whatever, you know, and bring those back. And some of that in a photograph, it's lost, it's gone. So you have to sort of manufacture it or bring it up as much as possible. That I really have a lot of fun with that. That's photo restoration. And I did a lot of that, you know, but that I always enjoyed that. I thought that was a great challenge. And it's also it's always a fun challenge too when a picture's almost all gone. It was a color, early color, and it's been sitting in the sunlight, been sitting on somebody's wall, and it's faded over 30 years, and they don't, you know, they bring it to you and there's nothing there.
Yep.
You know, and trying to tweak it and trying to bring it out, and
you just draw the picture.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, yeah. Sometimes it's like, how about a black and white? How do you feel about black and white picture? Yeah.
It was that the end of your story?
Kind of, yeah, because I was in at that point.
Well,
I
you
was
were in Starbucks.
He was part of...
No, that's right. You were at Foundation.
This guy's not even listening.
I was stuck at Starbucks because it was such a great part of the story.
But I have one quick story about Starbucks.
Tell me.
Actually, two.
Tell me both.
They're name dropping.
Okay. As long as you misspell the name on the cup,
we're
going to
get sued. We're going to...
I would like to say that Lisa Welchel is a very nice person.
I don't know who that is.
Facts of life. This is so dated.
Oh my God.
And still hot.
Oh, okay. Are those the two stories, or is that one?
Well, you know what? Given how successful that one was, let's just chalk it up as that.
Jeez, I don't know. Where did I leave off? Okay, so I think I...
Do you want to know?
Yeah, please. I think they had just announced the winners of Project Greenlight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
That's right. And the warehouse.
All the way from the Project Greenlight and How You Met Ray Wise.
Right.
That's
right,
where
right.
we were.
So, it was at Sundance in 2003. So, Project Greenlight. Not sure exactly what to say about that. There's a lot there. But in terms of it being part of my journey towards visual effects, it really had very little impact on my visual effects career because I was busy focusing on my directing career, which is really where I had been up until that point. And then after Project Greenlight was such a success that I said, I'm going to go into visual effects now.
It is amazing. Directors just can't hack it these days.
I like to have an effect on the visual aspect of a movie. So right. Then you were like, I think I'm really, really focused on that here.
Yeah, no, the transition was more of a post-Greenlight. You know, I spent some time writing scripts and shopping scripts around and kind of wanted to get back to the business of making something that I could show other than a script. So started making some short films. And like before Greenlight, I was exploring what I could do with visual effects in my short films. And so each short film became an opportunity to expand my skill set. You know, first it was, camera tracking, trying to see if I could track something in 3D into a very difficult shot. I'm like, what's the hardest? If it were a handheld shot, someone running and the 3D object is in the distance and it's being held in frame the whole time, that would be really challenging. So I came up with an idea, did that, and put it on YouTube. and that was fun. So this was something I continued to develop.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Now, you were out in LA for Project Greenlight, right?
I was already here.
Okay, so you remained in LA after that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because I had already moved here. I was here for 6 months before the Project Greenlight thing hit, and before even entered.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah. So I came out here because of the JJ connection, which didn't really coalesce yet.
Dong dong dong.
So busy, making shorts. And one of the shorts I made was my buddy and I, who we were still working together at the time. We had a story idea that we had developed on and off over the years, and we had a company that had approached us and said, "Do you have any horror scripts?" And we said, "No, we don't." But I said, "Well, what about this idea? It was a giant bug idea, basically a giant bug horror movie." So we sat down and started developing that for this budget of $100,000, which would have been a tight budget for a bunch of CG bugs. So I thought, well, I might be doing a lot of these effects myself. I should really learn how to do it.
For a feature film.
Yeah, I didn't know 3D.
Right.
I didn't know.
How hard could it be?
How hard could it be? I had dabbled with 3ds Max, but like I said before, I tried to learn it from a book and really hadn't gotten very far. So I had discovered the Noman School and their DVDs that you could buy to learn Maya. And I had also become aware that Maya was sort of an industry standard for feature film visual effects. So I was like, okay, I'm going to learn Maya. So I set about doing that, really just at home watching these DVDs.
How long did it take you to learn Maya, just out of curiosity, if people are listening that haven't tried?
I'm still learning Maya.
But I mean, where you felt like, I have a pretty good lay of the land. I mean, I know it's a super deep thing.
Well, the thing is, there's all these different aspects of Maya. And so I felt like I learned what I needed to learn in a few months.
Okay.
Because basically I said, okay, I want to do giant bugs. I need to shoot a VFX test. And again, made it into a little movie, a little short movie, a little 3-minute story. And it had a giant bug in it. And then I'm like, okay. So I sculpted the bug in clay. Like I went...
Oh, actual clay?
Old school. I did a maquette in clay. And then I started working out how to build it in Maya. And so that was a great way for me to test the knowledge and also to realize what I didn't know. I'm like, oh, okay, I don't know enough about UV mapping. I got to learn that. Or I got to learn more about surfacing or rendering or how to deal with hair or whatever. So that was how I approached learning Maya. And by the time that short was done, it probably took 6 months from sitting down with Maya the first time to having the short done.
That's pretty good. That's actually very good.
It was something like that. 6-8 months. I don't remember now. It was years ago.
Well, nothing beats having a goal to accomplish.
That's exactly
right. If you're just
right.
Dabbling, you might not ever get anywhere. But if that's you are trying to produce a result, then that's the best teacher right there.
That's right.
Everything by necessity.
And the short was not the story of the feature. It was just what would be a fun little goofy 3-minute short with a giant bug in it. So that was that. But the funny thing, the unexpected consequence of doing that short again with a story is that now it could be shown around. Now you can sit someone down for 3 minutes and they'll be engaged by the story and you can sell them. Basically, we use the short to say, hey, this is what it will look like. And on the merits of that, the project got passed to another set of producers who took it to Mel Gibson's company, Icon. This was before Mel, became Mel, the Mel we know today.
Right. Well skirted.
thank you. And the budget went from, $100,000 to basically $1.5 million.
Okay.
And
still pretty tight though, for that.
It is tight, but we were able to make that leap because we had done the short. Because the short sort of showed the promise of what this could be.
That could be a whole other podcast, by the way, the pitch. And how it used to be able to just sell a treatment. It used to be able to just sell an outline, then a treatment. Now people want to see something.
Well, I think for a very long time, and before we came along, supplementary materials and visuals were absolutely a must. That's why, you've got Ralph McQuarrie putting these amazing
concept
paintings for Star Wars. It wasn't just the, on based on George Lucas's amazing script.
That's a great point.
Or his charms. So, you know, studio heads and producers have always relied on visuals to get them excited. They want to know what it's going to look like and feel like. What's the experience of the movie going to be? And that's what you're trying to tease. But these days, it's so hard to get an original movie made that you pretty much have to make the movie to show it to them to say, this is what it's going to be like.
It'll be this. It's okay. This is a 2-hour pitch. It'll be exactly like this.
It'll be this.
As a matter of fact, here it is.
I just sunk $50 million into this. Can you just pay me back?
That's right.
And this can be yours. Yeah, it's kind of become like that. So that was, again, a journey towards directing that had all of this visual effects stuff sort of brought along with it. And I definitely feel like it's an asset as a director to understand visual effects. Yeah, I can sit down in a box and do them, and a director doesn't necessarily need to be able to sit down at a box and do the visual effects. But it is an asset to understand not only how things work, but why, and when to do things and when not to. Because I think if a lot of directors who don't know visual effects, they know all they think they need to know, which is you can do pretty much anything.
Right.
If it's on the, if you can write it on the page, if you can think it in your head, even if you can't visualize it, even if you don't have the ability to visualize a concept, you can put it on the page. Someone else will visualize it and they'll make it happen for you.
And you know what? They'll know it when they see it.
Yeah.
You got that.
So, you know, with that approach, you can do whatever, but it's not necessarily going to look good. It's not necessarily going to be effective or really be much of an experience for the viewer. So understanding how things are done and how to do things effectively, convincingly, how to not use visual effects, how to avoid using visual effects and do things practically, at sometimes how to mix the practical with the digital. And if you have to go with a CGI effect, knowing which ones will sell and which ones we're still not really that good at doing.
Right.
Or if you're on
a
budget.
It's a language. It's like, do you speak visual effects? It's a language, you know?
It's a tool. And like with any tool, whether it be color or whether it be film stocks or whether it be, you know, what lens you're using, are you shooting on a dolly, a crane, whatever. Like all of these tools of the visual language of film can be used well, and they can enhance or they can detract. They can be distracting or done poorly.
I still think we see that even in movies now. We see something where, like, I'm not sure why I'm watching that particular thing. You know, like, what is motivating that? You know, and it pulls me out. So I think it's not. No language is ever learned perfectly. You know, and there's a lot of wouldn't it be cool, which is always the what if proposition. You know. And that's a great place to start, but you also need to know what if it doesn't work, you know, and be able to go, okay, it doesn't work, you know, and let go of it. But
right, and the danger is, you know, of being really familiar with visual effects is to become overly reliant on them.
That's very true.
But that's true for any director.
And that's true in invisible of like visual effects, like not moving a C stand or just general laziness on set has now become a thing because you really can fix all that stuff.
Back in the day, if you accidentally had a C stand in the shot, you were kind of screwed.
Right.
Like
yeah.
you either made the decision to leave it in
and
hope no one noticed, or you cut the shot or you cut the scene, you know, whatever. Like it was a huge deal for the movie. And now, yeah, if it's an accident, you can be like, oh, shit. In the editing room, you're like, let's, you know, we got to pay to have that painted out.
Right.
But now it's gone so far that people are just like, should we move all that? Nah.
Exactly. Which means you're not getting the most bang for your VFX dollar because you have people cleaning that stuff. That money could be spent on something that's actually going to show up.
Well, look, if you already know that you're going to be matte painting that whole area, you know,
well, that's a different story.
Then
though.
You know you can leave a bunch of junk over there, and that's so people see that a lot. That's not necessarily laziness,
right?
But if you're just shooting a straight scene, and that doesn't require visual effects, and you're leaving stuff in, then yeah, that's sloppy, wasteful filmmaking,
right?
And there's, I think there's probably some of that in all.
I have not seen any, but I hear tell.
It's hard
a
to
thing.
Say.
I have heard about this.
Yeah,
yeah.
Not like we're ever hired to clean these things up.
Ever.
So I guess, I mean, does that qualify as my break?
No,
I'm still not being paid to do the thing.
No, right. Not yet.
Right. Okay. So let me get there. I'm sorry, folks. This is taking forever. Let me get there. so that film, the giant bug movie, is the one that did it. Basically, my filmmaking partner and I had a split in the development of that film, and we kind of went our separate ways, and he went ahead and was going to direct that project. And even though I was going to be integral in the visual effects, I originally was going to be a co-director on it. And so I was walking away from the project, and then the producers, who apparently didn't know about the drama between the two of us, called me and said, "Hey, we'd love to hire you to do the visual effects." I'm like, "Are you kidding?" I just walked away from this. I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. I'm like, I just turned my back on all of this nonsense, and now you want me to come back and be the visual effects guy? Really? And I almost said no on the spot, but I made a commitment to not making rash judgments or rash decisions, so I was just like, you know what, let me think about it.
I should learn that. So what was that again? Don't make rash decisions?
I forget. Something rash. If you've got a rash, right, don't lick it. I don't know. So
sleep on it.
So
sleep.
It took me weeks to decide, which actually is that's a good way to negotiate anything. Really take your time.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
So I finally was like, okay, you know what? If I can negotiate the terms that I want, then I'll do it, because we're going to be shooting in another country. We're going to shoot in Bulgaria. It'll be a fun experience. It's not going to be easy being on this movie set when I want to, you know, there was this drama involved. But it'll be good experience for me, you know, and I'll do these visual effects. I'll learn a lot. And, you know, that'll be fine. So
you'll get a podcast out of the deal.
I'll get a podcast, and here I am. So did that movie, shot in Bulgaria for 10 weeks, or was in Bulgaria for 10 weeks, and then came back, and the producers who did this film decided to start their own visual effects company with me supervising a team. And they hired PJ.
Oh, that was me.
That's how we met.
I didn't know this.
You didn't know this?
I'm totally joking. Oh, yeah, of course. I worked there.
Yeah, that's how we met. And PJ was, what would you say your position was at the company?
VFX producer, but probably not necessarily in the way it means anywhere else in the industry.
So really sort of a figurehead.
Oh,
yeah. What?
People, I would just do that lording I was talking about.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, that's
yeah.
right.
Yes,
I
yes.
just
yes.
lord
you,
a throne.
You had the throne, yeah. and yeah. it was very yeah. tall and yeah. swords on the back. and yeah, so PJ set up the whole company basically for doing visual effects, and I came in, and you hired everybody. I just told them what to do. You told them yeah. what they'd get paid.
Yeah, I was like...
So you were lording and you were sub-lording.
I was a sub-lord,
captain
yeah.
and executing and commander oh. kind of yeah. situation.
Tenille.
Yeah,
I was Tenille.
And we would trade those places a lot, right. I think.
So at the end of, what, 6-7 months working on that film, the film was done.
And you can see it because it's called...
I forget what it's called. And I'm sure maybe it'll be in the show notes if I can remember.
Maybe.
So at the end of that project, we got nominated for a VES award.
Yeah,
for the
it actually kind
oh,
of
I didn't know that.
Kind of sat
yeah,
around
cool.
in limbo for a while and then qualified for the VES. And yeah, we got the nomination. That was the first project for that place, my first nomination for VES, and you know, Ephraim's first big caliber gig, and it got, you know,
that's great,
got nominated. It's that's pretty prestigious, I think.
You oh, know what yeah. all that's three cool. of us have been nominated for a VES.
Wow,
there you go.
Right,
that's cool. Yeah. Wait, did you have the honor of paying $500 for your seat at the
that
VES?
Was actually
VES?
Picked up for me.
Oh, that's
and that's
nice.
A whole other thing.
That is a racket. Mm.
By the way, two things on that. The total racketness of that. Thank you. I'll just go build my own statue for that. But the other thing too is, it's a pretty awesome statue. The VES statue is the Meles moon shot. This is going to mean nothing. Maybe this is more of a show notes picture thing. Probably
the whole pie moon with the ship in the eye.
Right.
Thing.
The old timey. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But it's a really neat looking award. Although it lacks sharp edges, like the Emmy.
Yeah.
If you've never seen an Emmy in real life, you can stab somebody with an Emmy.
Nice.
Yeah. And
that'd make a great scene on daytime television.
Yep. Yep. That's when you know you've made it in.
That's
the
when you've stabbed someone with an Emmy.
But you know what?
Your own Emmy.
That's a metaphor too.
But yeah, since that time, Ephraim has been employed all around town doing all kinds of things.
That actually served you well.
Yeah.
Because that's put food on the table since.
Yeah, you know what? It turned out, and this is what I didn't expect to be a result of taking that job, is that visual effects turned out to be a really nice day job.
That's right.
And I say day job because I am still, you know, working, developing my own projects. I've got a project right now that we've mentioned before, a short film that I'm working on finishing up. And so, you know, visual effects, freelancing visual effects specifically, allows me the flexibility to make a chunk of change and then take a certain chunk of time off and live on that change, which now that I'm married and have a family is considerably more challenging than when I was a bachelor living on ramen noodles. To be fair, I never lived on ramen noodles.
No?
Never once.
They're not comfortable.
No. You cannot sleep on them.
I've tried. They're kind of pokey.
And they make a lot of noise when you turn over.
I know.
Yeah.
But I had a thought. I went out with the ramen noodles. But yes, that is a potentially more consistent gig than you know, a day job as a director, always having to find commercials and stuff, which is totally valid too. But there's probably more VFX jobs to be had just because it takes an army, you know, one director, you know, 15 VFX guys. So there's probably more of that work. I'm just saying
is a lot of VFX work floating around.
Right.
And since so many of the big houses have moved, like DreamWorks, Sony did move, didn't they?
Yeah, they're
Sony Imageworks.
I'm trying to think if it has entirely moved or if it's only mostly moved. I think it's pretty well moved.
I thought Imageworks was gone.
Yeah,
Is that the one that moved up to Vancouver or whatever?
I believe so.
Built a 15,000 square foot something.
Didn't DreamWorks also jump ship and go to Canada?
A lot of it, yes.
Yeah.
But it's smaller now.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
after a couple movies.
Like they've got a couple like commercial gigs and things that they do locally, but right. The big jobs are like
DreamWorks is in the chair next to you at your next gig.
Right.
You're like, oh,
hi, I'm DreamWorks. What? yeah, but most of those career folks, the full timers, that they move. They pack up
their homes,
and they move to another country.
Matter of fact, I know some folks who they are working on Game of Thrones, and they have to keep picking up. They're in Ireland now. I think most of that's in Ireland. And they were back briefly for maybe a month or two, but they have young kids. And so it's that show is just goes and goes and goes and goes, and the work is over there. So they're pretty much, they've lived in Ireland now for the last 4 years. I could ask them, but... it's a full commitment.
And, you know, there's part of that that's very romantic, and it sounds great. Right. I mean, forget laying down roots or buying a house, you know, but if you can be fancy free and live in Ireland or New Zealand, that sounds like a lot of fun. I, however, don't feel like if I'm serious about pursuing directing and making films, I can't be in Ireland.
And that's actually a great point. Maybe this is, you know, one of the reasons for this podcast was... negotiating those waters, you know, of how the three of us, I think it's fair to say, are multi-pursuers. You know, we're pursuing multiple things, you know.
Is that a...
Multi-pursuers?
Multi-pursuers. Ooh. Have you seen that movie?
Sounds naughty.
It's how it is. But I mean, by that, I mean, we have all been doing visual effects career-wise, but we also have other things, other irons in the fire.
So jack of all trades.
Exactly right.
Master of none.
Aww,
oh, what? I didn't say that.
I master all of them.
I'm a master of all.
Including this podcast.
A jack of none.
But I think it is in some fashion, it's never easy, especially if you have a family, but in some fashion, if your sole pursuit is visual effects, then that's easier in a way to wrap your mind around, like, okay, we're going to move the family over to Europe for X months or years or whatever, because that's what we're doing. That's our bread and butter. And that's okay. You know, like, that's what you're doing. But if you're trying to do multiple things, that does make it harder, because Los Angeles is still an important factor in building a directing career and other kinds of things, where you need sort of the network of Los Angeles, where that's harder to do if you're satellited out to New Zealand or wherever, I would think. I've not put this to the test.
Maybe if I had dual citizenship in a place like New Zealand or Ireland, maybe I could like get some of that government money. You know,
their
film programs where they fund filmmakers, and I'm speaking completely out of my hat because I don't know what their programs are, but it always seems like, you know, the New Zealand Film Board presents,
right?
It's like, Jesus,
right? Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
and the people of New Zealand are not thrilled
a
about
really
that.
Big tourism commercial,
right?
That's really
right.
Big.
That's right. 27 hour
and you know, and we live in this global economy now, but still, if you want to be taken seriously in Hollywood, you kind of got to be in Hollywood. If you don't take meetings 90% of the time, like, if you got to take one, you better be right next door.
And I've not put this to the test, but even there's visual effects houses like in Louisiana and stuff, and I would still feel a little like on my back foot, how do you say that, on my heels or whatever, like the things that I want to pursue, I don't feel I would be able to pursue those in full in a satellited area. Does that make sense? You know, like, I just feel like I don't have the resources. I feel like I'm a little disconnected.
Well,
you know?
I mean, I spent years trying to do it in Portland, Maine, I felt very disconnected.
Right.
Especially in the dead of winter.
Right.
But on the flip side,
you feel
maybe,
like you're in a frozen hell.
Yeah. On the flip side, maybe you need to unplug and you know, get a script done or something, so getting away from it might have its advantages.
Oh, I love that idea.
It's sort of, right. I mean, it's sort of like taking a job and having that as a side effect because you're going into another country. That's kind of, I don't know, to me that's like not really part of the deal. That's not a sales pitch I buy into.
You wouldn't want to go live in Ireland for a year and a half to do some.
If that's all you wanted to do, you wouldn't. You're like, I'm in, man. I'm 100% in.
They're like, you can come work on the new Star Wars, and we'll put you in this great position, and you'll get paid well, and you'll live in Ireland for a year and a half.
Eh.
You'd do it.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you would.
I wouldn't.
But if they were telling me.
I was waiting for the other shoe to fall. Not do it?
If they were telling me there were other side benefits to doing it, I wouldn't buy that. I don't know.
You
all the Irish food you want.
All the Guinness. But all the Guinness you want. And all the whiskey. Oh, you would go for the whiskey.
No. Not Irish.
Really?
Says the guy named Foley.
Right.
Is that an Irish name?
I responded to yours with an Italian accent. I have no idea why I did that. But
oh, Mr. Foley.
It's so true.
We've got your table right here. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
To all of Italy.
Well, is this a sign that it's time for our quick break?
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break right now.
We'll be right back with you.
Air conditioning.
In a minute. Bye.
Welcome back, ladies
Welcome
and gentlemen.
Back. I hope you enjoyed our sponsor reading, if we had one.
And if not, then the lack of break should have been
refreshing.
As refreshing for you as it was for us.
Yes. So, what we have kind of wanted, we've been talking about, Sean and I have been having some struggles at our current gigs right now.
We should say real quick that we have wrapped up our how to get into the business thing, I think. I should.
Yeah.
How we did it.
Yeah.
This is not a how-to. Don't do it like we did.
Right. There's got to be
three cautionary tales.
Right.
And as we've established, everyone's path is different. And that's kind of what we were trying to figure out, is how different can they be?
Sorry to cut you off.
And still lead you here. Yeah. So.
But where have they led us? Now we're going to talk about the actual job.
Yeah. Some of the nitty gritty. A little bit of the kind of things we run into a lot of times on different jobs. And I'll let Sean drum that up.
PJ and I were chatting back and forth in hip chat, because it's the hippest. And there is a thing that you do quite a bit if you're in the visual effects business, where a job will be started by one vendor. And then that vendor will lose the job for whatever reason. They weren't getting to the look that the client was hoping for, or the work had problems, or for whatever budgetary reasons. So many different reasons why a job can get passed from one
mass
client.
Mass suicide.
That's awesome. Yeah, so don't go with the Jim Jones visual effects thing, you know, and do not drink anything
in
the kitchen.
Don't show up for Kool-Aid Day.
Right. So, it just so happened that PJ and I, just two separate jobs, businesses altogether, ran into both of us have run into this thing. And it boils down to this, is that when one company loses the job, it goes to figure that another company inherits that job. So, and when you inherit that job, many times the client doesn't want you to start from scratch. They've already spent money. They've already done a lot of the work. And so they would ideally like for you to take the project files from the company that lost the bid and just fix, and I'm doing quote signs, big giant quote signs, fix the other company's work. And sometimes that's not crazy business. Most of the time, it's a headache. And it's a headache in this way. You often are inheriting, well, first of all, this is just true across the board for each artist. Each artist works differently. Everybody has a different brain. Everybody builds things in a different way that occurs to them at the time. So there's the one piece of the puzzle where you're inheriting just somebody else's work, and you have to sort of understand how they were getting to where they were getting. So you have to peel away the onion enough to see, oh, this thing is doing that and that. And then what you try to do is you kind of do a mind meld with the other artist. You try to pick up from where they left off in their comp and then build on top of that. So that's its own trick. The other trick is you're also inheriting all of the bad decisions that were made. And those are also part of the project files. So it is a, and then the potential third piece of the puzzle is trying to discern what the client was not liking about the work from the first vendor. And that's probably part of the conversation before you ever get the second bid happens. But then also trying to understand what communication was not happening that potentially caused some of that friction with the first client, and thus the second client is working on it. I was brought in to work on another project, but as often happens, once they have you in-house, sometimes they'll just throw other stuff that they have at you just to fill the time until the other project you were brought in for picks up speed and then is ready for you. Excuse me. But one of the things that is always a tricky thing to do is you're trying to serve several masters, and you are not wearing your own clothes while you're trying to do this. And that's a horrible analogy. I mean, it's all right analogy, but you basically
Whose clothes are you wearing today?
I've got a
good Armani.
Armani by way of Target.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, I think this is something you get better at the older you get and the more mature you get or the more experience you get, as you just sort of take in and try and figure the thing out. But there's always a trick of trying to find a way to get to the client's desire with what's oftentimes a train wreck that you're handed. And so many times the actual best answer is to tear it all down and start from scratch. Because sometimes back engineering something that is inherently broken takes more time than it would be to build it up from the ground up.
I think that's the case a lot of the time when I inherit work, even when there isn't a directive to change it, it's just a directive to finish it.
Right.
And I've inherited someone else's work. I've never opened up someone else's work and said, wow, this is done really well.
Exactly right.
I'm never like, this is so organized and well thought out. I'm just going to continue with this.
It practically
mindset.
Finishes itself.
It practically is like, just, I can see a straight line from here to where the finish. It's usually just a gigantic mess and things done in really inefficient ways that are like choking up your computer or eating up RAM, whatever. And you're just like, oh, God. It's much easier to just start over.
It is. And I think there's two pieces to that. I think oftentimes it is poorly built. I think other times it's just two different people do not think the same way, and what might be efficient to you might not be efficient to me and PJ and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, and I think we all have our internal ego sense of this could be a lot more efficient. Like I'm a minimalist if possible, you know. I try to keep the comp as lean as possible, and sometimes that's not always helpful. If you have a tweak on a tweak, then, and that's all buried in, that's getting technical. But the thing that drives me crazy is when there's a stack of plugins in something that could have been done. It's like Name That Tune. It's like you could have named it in two notes and you described it in 50,000 notes.
And then half the time those plugins are third-party plugins that you don't have, and suddenly the whole comp is jacked.
And I ran into that with this project. One thing was handed off to me, and it just loaded, and the whole thing was like broken. And the problem with not having the plugin is you don't know where it's breaking.
Right.
Was there a color correction? Was there a matte choke? What, you know, this is getting technical.
I had
technical.
One recently that was so bad in that regard that it would crash on open.
Yeah.
Because it didn't have the plugins. And I figured out the only way to open the project was to import the whole project into a clean project.
Which is insane.
Which is insane. And right. then you could get in there and start stripping things out. But, you know, like in terms of inefficiency, like one of the things I ran into on that same job, opening up someone else's work, is it's essentially a 2K shot that's being done. It was shot in 5K on the red. And for the show, all these things were then converted down, and that's what everyone was working on. But this person decided, for some ungodly reason, to revert back to the 5K red and work with that, which means it's virtually unworkable because
it doesn't move.
The computer's chugging so hard, and it's for every frame.
And it's being pulled through a server, too, on top of that.
So exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are cases where you have to... I mean, you can start over, but you don't always have that luxury. So you have to go in and think, you know, like, well, what can I collapse? What can I pre-render? How can I make this more efficient? So you spend half of your time sort of re-engineering what's there just to be able to work with what's there.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a vast topic that gets pretty technical, but it is... I find it equal parts. The company I'm working with right now happens to be really good. The guys that own the company are fantastic, and they get it. They know. And so when you go this, that, and they're like, I know. Sorry. What can we do? So they're very. It's a very open conversation with them, which is really helpful because they know you're not trying to do whatever, and they know what was handed to them. This particular project, it kept going back to the client, and the client. This thing is almost delivering, and the client's asking about frame rate.
Oh.
And resolution, like scale, like it's being finished at 720p at 2997, which is not the more. I mean that was an older HD format that's kind of gone by the wayside. There are still some broadcasts. That's still a broadcast format for some older, you know,
or cable network.
A cable network, you see that more. Yeah. And so I looked at it. I was like, oh, it's an old delivery format. I've run into it before, you know. And apparently the client was under the impression it was 1080p, 24p, you know, and or drop. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, you're having this conversation now.
That happens a lot.
I know, but it's insane to me because that is like,
it's like delivery specs like. Should be one of the first things that are nailed down on a job.
It's the foundation on which the entire building is built.
Right.
So it's like deciding that after the fact is like, oh, we should have put down some concrete, whatever they're called.
Yeah, I did a job recently where I was doing this whole 3D scene, or I was refurbishing a 3D scene. They said make it look better. Working on it for 2 weeks, and I had talked to the guy that I was working with, who is a permanent,
right?
You know, employee. He's staff, and I asked him, I'm like, what's the resolution of this? And he said, you know, 1920 by 1080. I'm like, okay, great. So that's what we're working in right up until like the day of delivery. The owner of the company comes in and says, no, this might need to go as large as 4K.
Scale 200%.
And I'm just like, well, why was that not communicated?
Right.
And you know, she was upset, understandably, but in, you know, it seems like someone at the top of the food chain needs to be managing those things, and very often in the smaller houses, those things really kind of get figured out along the way.
And that brings up like I always try to figure out, and PJ probably is a better person to describe this, but here's the thing that I find frustrating. I don't find it frustrating that things get screwed up. It's so complicated. It's bound to, you know, that I don't have a problem with. The thing that drives me crazy is that there is. Fear drives so much of the decision making because there's so many people that it's a competitive business, which I'm sure is true in Wall Street too and other competitive businesses. But there's this idea like that it's better to just bullshit your way through it than ask questions, because somehow by asking questions you're showing weakness. That causes more problems than anything, and I am absolutely 100% okay with somebody going, you know, I don't know. I'm like, good, because now a conversation could be had and we can do it right the first time.
See, when I absolutely have run into folks who are afraid to ask their client questions because they're afraid to, like you say, to look like they don't know. When I deal with clients, because I occasionally take on clients of my own, I have no problem asking them, because in my mind, it's going to make them feel better. And if they don't know, they're going to realize it's not going to make me look bad if they don't know the answer.
Right.
Right. So they're going to need to find out what the answer is, because it's ultimately what they need.
And for non-technical clients, which is many of them, it scares the shit out of them anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like just whatever you can do to make that as transparent and like open communication as possible, the better that will go. The last couple of things that I've bid on, I do a really complete bid, and I was complimented on the bid. You know, they were just saying, like, we have a very clear idea of what's going to go on. And I just feel like, for me, I feel like that just saved me all kinds of drama at the back end. You know, by having this open conversation where they can say, we don't want to spend that money. We will spend this money, but when I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. If it makes the overall experience happier, chances are that client will come back to you because they had a fantastic experience, you know? I mean, these are more micro things, but PJ's got, I'm sure, way more to say on.
Well, what? There's a couple different aspects that this comes down to, and one is just your own best practices.
PJ?
Yeah.
Sorry, man. Can you cue this up a little bit? Why you...
What?
Oh. PJ ran this deal.
Yeah.
He lorded it over.
I've supervised or produced for VFX for up to probably 25 people at a time. Sometimes just completely creating new pipelines for situations that come up. And to me, the pipeline is sort of what a VFX studio's secret recipe is. It's what makes one a little different from the other. No two companies like to work the same way. I doubt you could pick up from Digital Domain and go to DreamWorks and say, oh, good, it's all the same. No, it's not even going to be close. And I don't expect that to ever happen. There's not going to be the one true way of working probably ever, because different studios have their own software, choose their whatever their weapons of choice are going to just be different. It's what they've skilled up in for years. So what it comes down to then is there's a certain size of studio where the pipeline matters less. And I think Ephraim was talking about a company who was pretty big that you worked for, but they were still essentially sneaker netting.
I did.
Running. Oh, it was
I
you?
Worked for a commercial house. They were sneaker netting, and they had no business sneaker netting.
What is sneaker netting?
Running a thumb drive or a CD or another hard drive from computer to computer to get assets around.
Instead of having an internal...
And no server.
Wow.
And not only that, that's dangerous.
Because
what if you lose that drive? You've lost the entire work for that client. Yeah. There's money being spent on that sneaker net.
So, you know, there's companies that obviously need to get it together when... There's a size and an amount of work that's coming through where every man, every artist, they're no longer an island. They've got to work together. So someone has to know what to expect from someone else and keep the ball rolling. Then there's the individual artists need to have their own experience, their own lessons learned, where they know best practices. You know, don't save over versions, revise things properly.
Fill up your desktop with project
even
files.
Even if it's only for you, make sure there's a little bit of notation going on because you never know what's going to happen. Wherever you could put a little note in your comp however you can document something so you know when you're suddenly asked to come back to something 6 months or even 6 years later, what was I doing?
Or you could get suddenly hit by a car and the next day someone else is picking up your work and you're like, I never expected that. I've had something
didn't expect to get hit by a car?
I expected that. I planned it.
Planned for the car hit.
Yeah, it's actually not cheap to have someone run you over. But because there's all liability.
Those Russian camera things that you see on YouTube.
But you know, I've definitely had many instances where I'm working and I'm like, I don't need to name things inside my comp because I'm working on it and I know everything by sight.
Yep.
And you get very familiar with all the ins and outs of all these various things while you're doing it, but it's very easy for suddenly someone else is picking up your work. They're like, oh, we need you to work on this other thing. And Timmy here is going to pick up your...
Happens.
And I'm like, oh.
All the time.
Timmy, I'm so sorry. I know you're only 6 years old.
Can't speak, which is unfortunate.
I didn't name anything.
You know, the other thing, too, that that I have noticed about my own work is that if I'm tired, I can still get to the finished product. It still looks good, but the comps are sloppier, you know, cause I'm not thinking, I'm not my sharpest you know, and I'm like, it's three layers, and like, just do it with one layer. Don't do it with three, you know, or whatever the thing mm-hmm. that sort of that I can't put enough brain cells together to figure out how to make it cheaper.
You know? Go back into your own comp and you're like, what was this guy thinking?
Right.
Like,
oh, exactly. I should just start over.
It happens. It happens. You know, you're like, I don't remember doing that. You know?
Well, and so, yeah, you know, a couple other best practices, like save to a network and make sure that network is backed up. Things like that are important. And you get that through experience and good education. Now, where it kind of falls apart is a company is not taking the time to either create a pipeline in the first place, which is a big, big, that's a huge topic. But the other one is you get to a certain size and a certain, which is actually probably a size that's too small, where deadlines are too compressed, budgets are probably very tiny, and you kind of just on the fly have to hire a certain number of artists, get them working, and say, that's the content directory, save things there, go for it.
It's like a Hail Mary pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is really due to everybody is sitting down with someone who's experienced and saying, here's how we load things, here's how we save things, here's how we name things, here's where we store things, deliver things, all that needs to be really told to everybody. And in that way, as long as everyone's kind of doing that, you can recreate events to get problems solved.
Well, if you've got one person whose job, part of their job is to make sure, like, they're managing the pipeline, they're managing all the IT stuff, and they say, okay, when a new person comes in, I'm going to sit them down, orient them mm-hmm. for an hour or whatever on all the best practices in this particular house so that...
Yeah, when I started at Digital Domain, I was only there for, I don't know, 2.5 weeks or something like that, and they took 3 half days to train me, but I still was expected to work and work overtime on those 3 days.
To get their pipe.
You know, it's like, okay, so you're going to learn the stuff, but first get here and start doing this.
You know, one of the other things, too, that I think is also true, a pipeline is an art form. And I, you know, I will not name the company, but when I first started the company, it was smaller, you know, and they had a pipeline, but it was always in review. It was always evolving, which I think often they do. But you could generally, there was a flow. You could generally find stuff, you know, this company. So I hadn't worked there for a little bit, and then I, like, 2 or 3 years, and then I went back, and their pipeline had, the complexity of their pipeline had expanded quite a bit, and it needed to, because there were new tools being integrated and that kind of thing. The experience with a pipeline, that pipeline I felt was so complex that the time in the day that you were navigating the pipeline was substantial.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the answer to this. I don't have a better solution to this, because you do want proper accounting, especially for very large projects with lots of moving parts and artists coming in and going away. And you have to. But there has to be, or I don't know if there has to be, but I often wonder if there is a sweet spot for a pipeline where it's enough direction to organize, but where it is not so demanding of every I dotted, every T crossed in a specific, the top of the T should go X, should be X amount of millimeters or whatever, you know, to the point of where you spend more time navigating the pipeline than you do actually working. Mm-hmm. And I felt like my last experience with this company was heavily pipeline centric. And I was like, I am spending a lot of time with the pipeline, you know? So
when you say time, you mean learning it, or just like,
it is so deep. The pipeline is so deep. That rabbit hole goes for miles.
Oh, so you're just going into folder,
and digging. That's exactly right. And I think that is, you have to up to a certain point until we have better file structures. Hello, Microsoft and Apple and everybody else, you know, until that, a better solution to that. You know, some of that's unavoidable, because you do need a certain level of, you know, hierarchy to organize information. But anyway, so that's, I do think there is a sweet spot. I've seen things that are very close to that sweet spot.
Yeah.
But
there's a video on YouTube, Kevin Geiger, FMX08. He talks a bit about this. Like, the whole pipeline is not a science project. It's got to be, rigid, but still understand there's humans, working on it. Couple other rules about don't pass crap downstream is one of the biggest ones. Like, make sure everything you have is the way it needs to be handled by the next person down the road or stream. Can't really. Hmm. Yeah. Metaphors.
Yeah, road stream.
But anyways,
should we switch to some new media, or was there more?
I wanted to ask one quick question.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with, because you're dealing with a similar circumstance or situation? What's your method?
What I'm doing is taking the work that is in front of me and putting it back into the structure that's already established for everything else. So okay. What happened in this particular case is someone felt necessary to just do their own thing. And so I'm bringing it back to where I or anyone else knows how to find the assets again.
You're hooking it into the pipeline, basically.
It is taking so much longer than it needs to. And I keep finding little surprises, little things that it's like, how did this it doesn't work for me yet. Somehow it got delivered at some point where it was working for somebody.
Like nothing's connected, nothing. You can't find any of the files.
Yeah, it's like, that's always. Yeah, it's like the version that rendered is not the latest version on the drive. I can tell. I can tell. So, you know, things like that. I come from a lot of experience with this because way back at Foundation Imaging, we had to do an animated TV series from nothing.
Right.
And so we had to figure out a pipeline, and we created me and Jeff Sheets, who was the overlord of all that, that production, created something called Life of a Shot. And the idea behind that was that it was robust enough to, that's one of our favorite phrases, robust enough to recreate what state a project is in just by looking at the file structure. So you would move folders down the pipeline physically.
Interesting.
I guess it's always virtually in a computer, but right. They would move from one folder to the other to tell you what state that shot was in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then humans were there working on it, slowed stuff down sometimes, but people sort of optimize. Like we figure out what little steps of that were working and weren't working and what we could skip or just streamline. So it worked out pretty well. And I always use a version of that wherever I go inside of a pipeline now. And that's old. That's like 15 years old.
But if it worked, it worked.
Yeah.
You know, there's no.
Super simple and not database driven, but doesn't have all the bells and whistles maybe, but it's pretty cool.
The last one, the one that got pretty complex was database driven.
Yep.
And it was a lot of.
Yeah,
it was.
You can't make a move without going to the master control program.
That's exactly. It really felt like you were bound, and you had like two fingers you could work with. You know, like a little pincher video. Jeff went on to do what?
Found the Dave School.
So if you probably know about the Dave School if you're looking to get into the business.
Yeah. Dave School is still up and running, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. It is. Yeah. Doing well. So, shall we segue into what other things we're experimenting with or experiencing in our life?
Sure.
Go for it, guys.
Well, I've had a week of some new media. Just because I've been working on my short all week, so I've had a little bit of bandwidth open for taking in some other shows. Documentary, very interesting documentary that I mentioned to you earlier, Sean, Tim's Vermeer.
Oh, right, right.
And PJ, I think you had told me to check this out some time ago, and I finally got around to watching it. It's a fascinating story about, what is the guy's name?
Tim Jennison. New Tech, founder of New Tech.
Right. He's an inventor, tinkerer, visual effects pioneer who created New Tech, which went on to create Lightwave, which is one of the programs that's used out there quite a bit. And so he's got some thrown around money, and he has a lot of hobbies that he indulges in. And one of them is a sort of fascination with Vermeer, particularly in how Vermeer was able to create seemingly photographic realism in his paintings. Not just the detail, but the light and the way the light falls off and the way it interacts with different surfaces. And also the perspective and geometric qualities of all the objects and layout in the scene seem to be a little too perfect. And in that time, looking at other artists who were at sort of the top of their game, there is a major divide between their realistic paintings, which were clearly done by eye, and Vermeer's, which seemed to suggest that he had some magic that no one else had. And so Tim set out to not only figure out how Vermeer might have been able to do this, but to replicate it and to prove that it was possible to paint a Vermeer painting himself. And he was obsessed with this idea, and he's like, it's going to be quite a feat, considering I'm not a painter. I've never painted anything.
And did you hear a little aside about that? Is he's been personal friends with Penn and Teller for a long time,
right?
And Teller heard that about this pursuit, and he's like, "Wait, don't do it yet."
Wait, Teller didn't say that because Teller doesn't.
Oh,
speak.
Yeah. Well,
he said he went like this. He went,
mm-hmm. Which was really
yeah. And so he knew that maybe Teller's onto something. Mm-hmm. And so in his next moment of silence, I believe he expressed that they could make a documentary out of this pursuit because it's pretty freaking, it's nerdy in a great way.
So the documentary is directed by and narrated by Penn Jillette.
Mm-hmm. So
I think it's directed by Teller, but whatever.
So really?
I don't know. I'm probably wrong.
You might be wrong. But so, I'm not sure.
What's your opinion? Wrong. Or how'd that go?
For those of us in the know, it's the one on the left.
So are you going to spoiler alert? I actually have books on this. I know how it was done, but do you want to spoil
it? No, I don't want to spoil it because it's a fascinating documentary and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, definitely see it.
There's also, I have a David Hockney is a pretty famous artist, fine artist, and he wrote a whole book. I have it on there, and he talks about Vermeer. That method was more than one person was onto that method.
Okay.
So,
well, after the podcast, we'll discuss it, but I don't want to spoil it for anyone.
Gotcha.
PJ, what have you been absorbing?
Well, I've been using HBO Now.
Oh, what do you think?
Quaint little Apple TV.
Untethered from the cable subscription, how do you find it?
I love it. I think technologically it's a little behind Netflix playback, like fast forwarding, rewinding, bookmarking a series and picking it up. It's all a little more difficult, but it's all about the content. Mm. And so, yeah, I'm caught up on Game of Thrones. Nice. And yeah, I cry myself to sleep over that all the time, of course.
You passed me for the longest time. You hadn't even started the series, but and now you've
it does do like Netflix, like next one's up in 30 seconds.
Which, of course, just, you go, yes, Pebble.
Yeah. I'm not tired.
If you can hold it, you don't have to go to the bathroom.
I'm not tired. I can watch more.
Now, do you skip over the opening credits, or do you, is that part of the experience?
I watch like the first two episodes of every series to see what's changed.
Oh, and the opening credits.
Yeah, in the opening credits. Because
they keep building new realms. Mm-hmm. By the way, I love the opening credits in Game of Thrones. It's so well done. It's such a cool look, you know, it's a fun way in.
So
yeah, but I'm sick of CGI.
Yeah.
The whole opening is CGI. I'm just so sick of it. They should have done that practically.
It does ruin
with a
story.
Real map.
I know. I don't like any of it.
Fuck CGI.
Except for all of it. I don't like the... I like it all.
Finally caught up. I do think it's a pretty cool service for those cable cutters who want the good shows.
And now they have Sesame Street. So
yeah, apparently so. I've also been watching season 2 of Silicon Valley, which gets to my whole, I don't know, I've been
a
follower. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those are my people that I've never actually worked side by side with, but I feel for them. And I've been, you know, always read up on all the Silicon Valley happenings. So it's great and hilarious in that Mike Judge kind of way. That's the right guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Here's a question about the HBO Now thing. So here's my thought on like HBO Now, presumably it's only HBO content, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of a business model, I've been curious about this because Netflix, they're curating it. Not really, but that's everybody's game. Whoever, they don't care who creates the show. So arguably, their content base is always evolving and never ends. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, is it possible at some? I don't know how long this would take. Maybe it's unrealistic to you. Don't have enough years in your life to watch all the content HBO's produced. Maybe, I don't know. I just wondered. It is a limited content base.
Right.
Do you eventually exhaust it, or?
Well, I think you actually could, but. What's great about it is that you could just stop and start whenever, like take a month binge and then take a month off wait till a new season of something starts.
So you turn off the subscription Oh, that's cool.
But you know, also they're never going to compete unless they change their business model drastically. They're not going to compete with Amazon Prime or Netflix streaming because, as you say, those libraries are ever evolving and they're huge. But HBO now has picked up Sesame Street, which on the surface seems like a very odd choice considering the kind of adult programming that they produce. Not a lot of children's TV on HBO. So now they've got this classic children's program that for, you know, the last 30 years has been free and available to, basically it's like parenting for, you know, and babysitting for low-income folks, and now it's part of their subscription model. I think maybe this is a first step in an attempt to grow that whole library in a way that they can pull in more people.
So this is the first indicator that they're willing to buy other people's content. And so do you feel like that was for low income housing or low income?
Well, not only, but it was certainly it was an option for a lot of families that didn't have. You know, you've got a bunch of kids. You don't have, you know, no one can watch them. There's not a lot of parenting going on. Maybe because people are working and working three jobs, is trying to, you know, make ends meet. And Sesame Street was a great resource for learning and entertainment.
I grew up with it. I watched it growing up.
Because you were poor.
I guess so. But the thing that I always really appreciated it about it was that it's really cutting edge. It had multicultural things way before that. I mean, it started in the 70s where there was more emphasis on multicultural entertainment, especially for kids. Like you look at Schoolhouse Rock and all of that, you know. And then I think recently, or maybe not so recently, they have gay characters on Sesame Street. So it's, you know.
They always did. They just weren't out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, exactly. Welcome to the world. Well,
you know, I think it is a very nice strategic play, but they have competition from themselves also. Like if you dip a toe into cable subscription, it's about the same price to get HBO again from the traditional cable route. And then you get to use the HBO Go instead of HBO Now for no additional charge. And then, unless it's superseded, I don't think it is yet by the HBO Go. But then, if you start a la carting all these services, you're ending up paying as much as a cable bill again.
Because
there's Showtime, there's HBO, there's ESPN, NFL.
Ooh, you know what? You've just described a business model, a new business model.
Well, we'll see what Apple does.
Packaging all those services. Well, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. But I think that those companies are all recognizing that. Media consumption habits are changing drastically.
Right.
But they have changed.
People want to watch what they want to watch when they want to watch it, period.
Yeah, and they don't want commercials.
Right.
They don't want, you know, the same old bullshit doesn't apply anymore. And people want a different experience.
And binge watching.
And binge watching.
Like, that's a thing. That's now, like, before it was like, well, nobody's going to want to watch a whole season. Like, you want to bet?
We're saying it's a thing, but there's a whole generation that's growing up not knowing anything else.
Exactly, right. Exactly. That's right.
You know?
And why wouldn't I get all 13 episodes or whatever? However
I love 15-hour movies.
And I know. And, well, they are, pretty much.
And these new generations are impacting, you know, the parents and how they're watching. So everything is changing. It's changing very fast. And all these companies are just sort of scrambling and on board.
And that's what it is.
HBO is a little late to the game, honestly, because it took them forever to let go, to untether to their cable subscription.
Here's the...
That's the old model. They were still kind of grappling with.
It's a tricky proposition, though, because there are relationships that are 35, 40 years old with HBO and the cable providers. So that's not an easy move for them to make.
I'm sure there are a lot of good reasons why it took them so long, but they were still late to the game.
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't disagree with that. I just think it's interesting. You know, it's not about what technology is available, although it is now, but it's where the power structures are. But the thing that is new is you have fast movers, giant movers. Like before, you know, frankly, it would have been Time Warner, whoever. They'll dictate what service you get and you'll like it and you'll shut up.
Yeah.
You know? And now with the Googles of the world, the Amazons of the world, they're like, F that. F that. You know, let the customer decide. And that is the seismic shift in that, in where you find content, who's going to provide it, and that kind of thing. So I have one quick thing. How are we doing?
Yeah, do it quick.
just to find and it's not a big one. I've been gigging this last week, so it's been, you know, just been listening to podcasts and stuff. But Radio Lab, one of our favorite podcasts, had a good one. It might have been a reprise or whatever you call it. But there was a story about a family who had twins. She was pregnant with twins, but one of them didn't make it to term. Have you heard this whole thing?
I have, yes.
It's fantastic. And it the end of that, I don't want to spoil the podcast if people want to listen to it. It's right. Can we do show notes on
this? Oh yeah, okay. Of course.
But it is why Radiolab is so good, because they come to a profound moment at the very, do you remember the end
yep.
of that?
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to hold back tears. I'm working at a business and I'm like,
yeah,
I will not cry.
That episode did not do that to me, but I've come close before.
Is that the donation one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I did hear that.
But
yeah.
The woman, the mother has a profound, coming to terms with what this all means in a bigger way. That is to me like,
meaning of life type of stuff.
It really is. And yeah. And for her to come to that conclusion is profound enough. I mean, it's roundly profound. But then, you know, Jad Abumrad and Robert Coleridge, and I think Jad does all the sound mm-hmm. stuff, like, brings it home sonically. First of all, from an editorial perception, they know that's what you end on. So that already is great. And then to bring it home with the music, and then to know to leave space after that with just a little music bed before they kick in with the thanks, you know, the credit sequence or whatever you call mm-hmm. it. That there, it's pitch perfect.
A lot of their episodes are really very emotional.
They are, and like listening to them when you're at a job, you're like, I hope I'm in a corner working. I have to turn it off. You know,
blubbering at the end of like there's one called Lucy about. This is about a study of apes.
Okay.
And that's all I'll say.
Right.
But I was just a wreck after listening to that. I was like, God.
Speaking of wrecks, if you want to do a quick wreck, if you want to go wreck yourself right now, there's a viral thing running around about somebody cut together all the videos of deaf people who are getting that thing where they're hearing.
Right.
That'll drop you to the floor in 2 seconds. Every time I was like, that's so awesome. That's so amazing. But anyway, so if you want a good note to end your evening on, that and yeah. maybe not Game of Thrones.
So we'll put a link to cochlear implants on our show notes as well.
All right.
And how to, a DIY cochlear implant.
That will get us listening to this and you're deaf and you need to. Yeah.
Oh. Hey, that's another podcast listener we could get.
Yep. That's right. That's exactly right.
The greedy bastard in me sees it that way.
All right.
More cochlear implants equals more listeners.
More money. Benjamin. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for listening to yet another 10 Giant Robots podcast.
We'll catch you next time.
And music bed.
10 Giant Robots is created and distributed by the 10 Giant Robots Radio Network in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. Our theme music was created by the incredibly talented Shane Knight. Follow us on Twitter at 10 Giant Robots or at 10giantrobots.com.